Hey guys, my name is Moses. You might know me from the Sunday protests. Hopefully I've given all of you a lolly at some point. I am one of the members of Dingo Team, the mental health team for CDMS. We are the group that does security for various protests. We do support and community stuff. I should speak up. Anyway, yes, I'll be emceeing for you today, guys. I'll start with the nuts and bolts. Now, restrooms are around the back. We have disability support for that stuff. We have ramps. Upper. Normally, I just shout. Right, so restrooms are around the back, guys. Today's event is being hosted by Dadi Monworo. This is the location that we're at. They are very graciously giving us this space for free, which is fantastic. If you have the capacity, please feel free to donate down the back. We've got cash. You can also go to the cafe and ask to donate via FPOS. That's all my nuts and bolts. So, my name is Moses. Great to see you. CDMS, as you know, are heavily involved in various struggles, various support stuff. However, going for a walk every Sunday only gets us so far. If we're going to get somewhere, we need to come together. We need to bring our movements together. We need to educate and learn, meet each other. And that's why I'm so excited, truly a highlight of my activism career, to be emceeing an event for Professor Gary Foley. But yeah, that's about all that I have, really. Comrade Guinevere is going to give us a little opening. Thank you so much. I'm very nervous.
Now it comes back down. Welcome, comrades. It's really good to see people here. And of course, what is most important is that this is one of a series of discussions working out where we are at. Politically, where are things? But the most important of those to start off with is to recognise the struggles that have taken place on this land for tens of thousands of years. Now, one of our major speakers today is Gary Foley. His picture's up there when he was younger. But just to let people know about Gary, for those of you who haven't already come across him in the past, Gary is an activist. He comes from New South Wales in the first place, and he left school long. We were introduced to him then as Professor, and he is a professor now. But when he was first an activist, he wasn't any of those things. He was an activist, and still is. And that's the thing that's so important. First of all, he went to Sydney. And for those of you who don't know Sydney, Redfern is the black community area in Sydney, and certainly was in those days, because we're talking 1967, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was 1967 that he went to Redfern. And in those days, and most of you you'll all know, oh yes, there are Aboriginal legal services, Aboriginal health services, Aboriginal housing services. None of those existed in those days. Not one. Gary was one of the people who was involved in setting up the legal services in Sydney. Going way back then. Personally, I've known him for... it wasn't quite 1967 when we met. I think it was 1969 when we met. But learning from not only Gary, but also comrades from here who are also setting up legal services, health services. One of the things that we in Brisbane learned from these people was what they had done. And so we then set up all of those, the Aboriginal legal services, followed by health services, followed by housing services in Queensland as well. So we have learned from each other in that time. But Gary has gone way beyond what many of the rest of us have done, in that he did go on and become an academic. He runs a setup at Victoria University, which is actually bringing together a lot of the history of the struggles that have gone on in that process. One of the other things that he did when he was much younger, by the way, was he got to be a movie star as well. Hey. And so a number of you may have seen the things that he was involved in there too. So I would like everybody to thank Gary for taking us through at least the beginning of the Aboriginal struggles in Australia, because let's face it, CDMS, we're here to defend the right to struggle, the right to have rallies, the right to be in the streets. That's what we're here for, and making sure it can happen. But we haven't always been here. We need to learn from the past. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Gwen. As Gwyneth has said, we've known each other a long, long time. Today, I'll put the mic down here because I'm going to have to look at the screen at certain points to see what I'm supposed to be saying. I've plucked together two talks today, drawing from some of the stuff that I teach at Victoria Uni, in the hope that it'll give you a little bit of an idea about the history of some of the things you observe in some of the rallies to do with Aboriginal rights these days. I've divided it into two parts, this talk. I want to talk in the first part about some history that happened 100 years ago, which saw the emergence of the first modern Aboriginal political organisation in the 1920s, an organisation that was incredibly significant to this very day. If I seem a little confused, just because I am, I'm getting old. As Gwyn pointed out, I was a bit younger there when that photo was taken. If you'll bear with me, I'm going to walk you through some history that I consider to be significant and important for you to have at least some sense of. Because I'm technically and legally blind, I'm not sure what's on some of these slides. I've got to remind myself as I go. So if I stand here looking and seeing what I'm trying to say, that's why. I always start my talks with this. This is the political landscape, if you like, of Australia for about 80,000 years BC, before Cook. As you can see, there were 500 different nations, 500 different language groups around Australia, many of which no longer exist, but that's, we'll get to that later. But for the purpose of this morning's talk, and at the risk of possibly offending some of my brothers and sisters from other parts of Australia, I have to tell you that of all of those 500 nations, this mob here on the north coast of New South Wales, it has been established through extensive research conducted by one of Australia's foremost Indigenous historians, namely me. It's been established that the Goombangia people were, in fact, the best looking and the smartest of all of them grandfathers. That's your first lesson in Aboriginal history. These are a couple of quotes which sort of give you an indication of the way in which Aboriginal peoples' experience have been effectively written out of the history books of Australia. And it's only in very recent times, since the 1970s, that the Aboriginal voice in Australian history has only just begun to be heard. Not going to talk much about invasion and the frontier. Suffice to say, here is the history of the invasion in 30 seconds. There you go, folks. That's the invasion in 30 seconds. The important thing in terms of Victoria, people might, unless you come from somewhere else in Australia, you may not wonder this, but people ought to wonder why Aboriginal people are so thin on the ground in Victoria compared maybe to other parts of Australia, like where I come from. And here's the reason, in essence. These are just some of the recorded massacres that occurred in this part of Australia, which is why Victoria ought to be regarded as the killing fields of mainland Australia. By 1857 or something, only 1,700 Aboriginal people were still alive in Victoria after just 15 years of invasion and occupation. Now, by any stretch of the imagination, that sort of population reduction in this part of the country can only be considered as an act of genocide. After the initial invasion and massacres and all the rest of it, at some point, governments in Australia, under pressure from England, the mother country, had to change some of their tactics. And it evolved into the notion that government should be smoothing the dying pillow, because by the by about the 1850s, it was considered that Aboriginal people were dying out because of their coming into contact with the superior civilization of the British. Aboriginal people, being considered as inferior races, were believed to be dying out. This wasn't just something that was restricted to Australia. The same sort of notions emerged in Aotearoa, the land of the wrong white crowd, and in the United States and in Canada. But the important thing that we need to understand about this sudden change in policy is that these ideas emerged out of a fake, a pseudo-science that emerged in the mid-19th century called eugenics. Now, eugenics is an important thing to understand in the early history of Australia, because eugenics not only played a key role in the assimilationist, in other words, genocidal policies that dominated most of the 20th century, but they were also, also continue to this day. Eugenics, as I said, was an idea that emerged after Charles Darwin published his Origin of the Species, and it was his cousin, Sir Francis Galton, who came up with this idea of eugenics. And the idea of eugenics initially had to do with the upper class in England deciding that the lower classes, the working classes, and other races, namely the Irish in this instance in England, were inferior and needed to be controlled. And eugenics was an idea that said that you could breed out the unfortunate types in society and encourage the breeding of the superior types, the upper classes. But this idea broadened, and in Australia, the impact that eugenics had can be seen from when I went to university. Now, as Gwyn pointed out, I ended up going to university very late in life. You'll see in the second part of today's talk why I ended up going to university late in life. But when I finally did, well, what prompted me to go to university at almost the age of 50 was some academic at the University of Melbourne insulting me one day, suggesting that I was somehow a lesser person than them because I didn't have the magic letters PhD after my name. So I thought to myself, I actually said to that person, well, fuck you, I'll go and get you a little Mickey Mouse bit of paper. I said, it mustn't be too difficult, you're that one. And so I ended up a mature age student, almost 50 years old, in the midst of all of these young, smart minds who was going to Melbourne Uni, all the kids of the upper classes, the rich kids and the children of the oligarchs of Asia and places. And it was an interesting exercise. It was an interesting exercise because one of the first things I discovered was a lot of the buildings where I was going and attending lectures in were named after people who I considered to be war criminals. People like Redmond Barry. Redmond Barry is probably well known to some of you as the man who hung Ned Kelly. He's the bloke whose statue sits outside of the State Library and gets shat on by a million pigeons every year, which means he got his just desserts. But most of the eminent, what were considered by the British to be the eminent people of Melbourne, early colonial Melbourne, were staunch, hardcore advocates of eugenics. Another one who was an advocate of eugenics, Baldwin Spencer, the supposed father of Australian anthropology, an ardent eugenicist. There's the building named after him that I had to attend lectures in. But by far the worst of the crew at Melbourne University was this guy, Richard Berry. In fact, when I was going to Melbourne Uni, this building was called the Richard Berry Building. It's on Swanston Street. You might want to wander past it these days because you'll see that it's no longer called the Richard Berry Building, because when I was going to uni there, Tony Burch and I started a campaign to have this building's name changed for reasons I'm about to tell you. They didn't change the name while either me or Tony were at Melbourne Uni, but about 15 years later, they finally got round to changing the name, just on the verge, just on the beginnings of the Black Lives Matter movement, which started to address issues like this worldwide. So Melbourne Uni got in just in time and changed the name of the Richard Berry Building. But Richard Berry was one of the most notorious advocates of eugenics of all time. He claimed that eugenics was the most important part of his work, and as part of his notions of, he had these ideas that Aboriginal peoples were inferior, and in order to prove his theories about their inferiority, he became one of the biggest collectors of Aboriginal skulls in Australian history. In fact, when I was at Melbourne Uni as a student, I found out, and this is one of the reasons Tony Burch and I started this campaign, I found out that there were still, in the anatomy department at the University of Melbourne, when I was a student there, there were still 300 Aboriginal skulls and other skeletal and human remains in the anatomy department at the University of Melbourne. Now, as luck would have it, when I began my studies at Melbourne Uni, I was at the time the senior curator for Southeastern Australia at the Melbourne Museum. And I was aware, because of that, I was aware that the retention of Aboriginal human remains by that stage of history in Melbourne was illegal unless you had a permit. And the only person who could issue a permit at that time was the senior curator for our Indigenous thing at the Melbourne Museum. So as a humble undergraduate student, I was able to go to the Vice Chancellor's office at Melbourne Uni and point out to him that I could have him arrested because the university was retaining all of this Aboriginal human remains. Well, as luck would have it, the Vice Chancellor freaked out and ordered an audit of the university, and he found that there were more than just what was in the anatomy department. There was considerably more human remains in other departments, all of which eventually got returned to the proper repository, which at the time was the Melbourne Museum, who in turn had the responsibility of identifying those remains and, where possible, returning them to the people from whence they came, the Indigenous people. So Richard Berry was a particularly notorious character. In fact, in the 1930s, he sponsored this, the Mental Deficiency Bill, which sought to sterilise a considerable part of the population, amongst whom Aboriginal people were included. Now, it's a very interesting thing. This was passed by the Victorian government, this legislation. However, just a few years later, at the end of the Second World War, what a remarkable coincidence, the end of the Second World War. What happened at the end of the Second World War? The world became aware of what had happened in Germany and Poland during the Second World War, and this particular bill conveniently disappeared. Right? So eugenics was formed the basis of the ideology that developed the assimilationist policies that emerged around the beginning of the century. One of the most notorious eugenicists, along with Richard Berry, was Mr. A.O. Neville, who was the chief protector of Aborigines in Western Australia. As such, he had control over every aspect of the lives of all of the Aboriginal people of Western Australia. And in order to prove his belief that he could breed out, along the lines of eugenics, the idea of eugenics, he believed he could breed out the Aborigine in Aboriginal people. And because he had control over the fertility of Aboriginal women in Western Australia, he was able to conduct his own racial experiments to the point where he wrote a book about it. And here's a photograph that he took from his book, which he contended showed that he could breed out the Aborigine in just three generations by taking an Aboriginal woman, making her have a child with a white man, having that child have him have a child with a white man, and in the end he ends up with what he believed to be a white person. So these are the sort of racial experiments that were being conducted on Aboriginal people in Western Australia at the same time as another group of people in another part of the world were conducting very similar experiments. And those people, of course, were the Nazis in Nazi Germany. So Aboriginal people were being subjected to similar racial experiments as the Nazis were conducting during the Second World War. It's a terrible thing not being able to read anymore, folks. Now, at the in the 1850s, something else happened in Victoria that very simple, there was a gold rush, and suddenly people from all over the world came heading for Western Victoria, joining the gold rush. And amongst those hordes of people who were coming from other parts of the world were large numbers of Chinese. Now, this freaked out the British gold miners in the gold mines. And it generated a massive racial paranoia in Australia, because suddenly the British in Australia realised that they weren't living in a nice white part of the world like Europe. They were living in a part of the world where everywhere around them there were not only coloured folk, there was hordes of these coloured folk. And the British felt very vulnerable. This cartoon sums it all up, you know. They were scared shitless that they could easily be swamped. The British remembered how easy they thought it had been to take over Australia from the Aboriginal people, and they realised with all these hordes of non-whites surrounding them down here in the Southern Hemisphere, they were susceptible to be overtaken by Chinese or who knows, any mobs of these coloured hordes who were surrounding them. And so consequently, ideas of eugenics combined with the racial paranoia that swept Australia at the end of the 19th century and formed the basis for ideas about Australia needing to federate to become a last bastion for white supremacy in this part of the world. And as a result, you saw this sort of shit. You saw this filthy racist propaganda, such as this is one of the more notorious pieces of propaganda that were being spread at the time, demonising and vilifying in particular the Chinese, but all other coloured folk as well. Do you want your homes built by white or yellow labour, folks? You want a white home by white labour? Go to Charlie, what's his name, in Gertrude Street, Fitzroy. Or while you're getting your white home built, how about eating white Australian pineapples, folks? And if you're doing that, then why not play a game while you're at it? The white Australia game. Get the coloured men out and the white men in. You know, and it extended into theatre, into all aspects of Australian society, this vicious, vicious, racist propaganda, to the point where, and this masthead and the bulletin was still there when I was 16 years old, folks. This is how solid ideas of white supremacy became part of the Australian psyche. And here is summed up in one simple cartoon. Here's the real reason why Australia became Australia, why federation was important. It was to keep the hordes of coloured folk, be they yellow, brown or whatever, keep them out. That's why Australia became Australia. And so it was. In the old building in Carlton Gardens, Australian Parliament, first Australian Parliament, had its official opening. They then adjourned to the Parliament House in Spring Street, Victorian Parliament, where they held their first hearings. And what was one of the first acts of the first Parliament of Australia? The Immigration Restriction Act of 1901, better known more notoriously as the White Australia Policy. Now, it was important for them not only to keep all of these coloured hordes out of Australia, they had to look within Australia as well. And they had a couple of problems. One of them was us, but they weren't worried about Aboriginal people because the firm belief was that Aboriginal people would die out within the next generation or so. So that would be the end of our Abos. There'd be no worries about them. They're gone. But there was another problem, and that was all of the Pacific Islanders, many of whom had been kidnapped and brought to Australia as slaves to create the Queensland sugar industry. By 1901, the sugar industry's the hard yak has been done by all of the slaves, and they were no longer needed. So they needed to get rid of the Pacific Islanders. So along with the White Australia policy, they came up with the Pacific Islanders Deportation Act. And that got rid of 10,000 Pacific Islanders, except for a few who managed to hang on and stay on in Australia, and in many instances, intermarry with Aboriginal families up and down the east coast of Australia. So, Australia becomes Australia in order to be that last bastion of white supremacy in this part of the world, a haven for the white English race. And so, just to kill a butterfly with a sledgehammer, let's have a look at what some of our early prime ministers had to say on questions of race. The first Australian prime minister: the doctrine of equality of man was never intended to apply to the equality of the Englishman and the Chinaman. The second Australian prime minister: you folk can read this, I can't see it. The third Australian prime minister: the fourth Australian prime minister: the sixth Australian prime minister. I'm trying to see. And so it goes, folks. These are all of our earliest Australian prime ministers, making it absolutely clear that white Australia is what it's all about. That's why Australia became Australia. So, in the early 1900s, immediately after Federation, Australia was a cauldron of notions of white supremacy. And so it was that into this filthy cauldron of white racist notions, who should in 1908 walk but the most hated black man on the planet Earth in 1908. And who was that man who was hated universally? This bloke. This, folks, is the legendary Jack Johnson, African-American, who was the world's first black heavyweight boxing champion. And hence, the world hated him. Because remember, in America, Canada, in Europe, in Australia, notions of white supremacy reigned supreme. And Jack Johnson disrupted those notions because they couldn't find a white man to beat him. And, well, let's just look for a moment at Jack Johnson.
This is the story of a proud and flamboyant man who was the first black boxer ever to win one of the most prestigious titles in sports. Between the years 1908 and 1915, he ruled the heavyweight division as no man had before him. But at the turn of the 20th century, his carefree lifestyle was despised by many of his fellow countrymen. A cry for the great white hope echoed across the land as sports fans awaited his downfall. Today, his legend lives on as one of the most controversial figures in the history of sports. But he remains one of boxing's best, Jack Johnson.
Jack Johnson was born in 1878 of parents who were slaves. He was born in Galveston, Texas, but left home at the age of 12 to work. He worked for a while as a sponge fisherman. He was a painter. He was a potato peeler. He worked on the docks and started fighting at the age of 13. He had his first professional fight at the age of 16 years.
What was the reaction of the American public to a black man who was coming along and having an eminence in a sport that was predominantly a white man's sport at that time?
Well, in 1907, 1906, when Jack Johnson was demonstrating that he was the greatest heavyweight in the world, at that time there had been five white heavyweight champions: Sullivan, Corbett, Fitzsimmons, Jeffries, and Tommy Burns. Interestingly enough, Jack Johnson had to chase Tommy Burns all over the world in order to get a shot at the heavyweight championship. But at that time, the public did not want a black man to be the heavyweight champion of the world.
Jack Johnson chased heavyweight champion Tommy Burns all over the world for the title he wanted so desperately. Wherever Tommy Burns went, Jack Johnson would follow. Johnson and his manager Sam Fitzpatrick borrowed thousands of dollars and pursued the champion in France, England, and then finally back in Sydney, Australia. Tommy Burns had won the title by decisioning Marvin Hart in 1906, finally in 1908. After seeing both Burns and Johnson in action, some English reporters wrote that Johnson was Burns' master.
December 26, 1908, Rush Cutters Bay at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Round one. 26,000 fans hold their breath. Burns is defending for the 12th time. At 6 feet 1 and 212 pounds, Johnson is lean, hard, a master craftsman who loves to set his own. Now Johnson pours it on. Lifts, rights, hooks, uppercuts. Burns is defenseless. At this very moment, the police shut off the cameras and stop the fight.
His victory had provoked race riots all over the country. Jack Johnson's ambition and talent and quick wits, his extraordinary financial success, fondness for fast living, and refusal to follow rules set by others had all helped make him a hero among many black Americans. But most whites, who still saw the country as theirs to run, found those same qualities when embodied in a black man a dangerous threat. Still worse from their point of view, Jack Johnson didn't seem to care what they...
That's right, Jack Johnson didn't give a damn what they thought. 26,000 people turned up in Rosscutters Bay in Sydney to watch that fight. It was the biggest sporting event in Australian history right up until the 1956 Melbourne Olympics, folks. That's how big a deal that was. And as you heard, the police had to stop the fight to save Tommy Burns from a bigger flogging. Now, what I hear you ask is Jack Johnson doing in this story about Aboriginal history? It's very simple, folks. In that crowd of 26,000 people, 25,998 of those people were white Australians anxious to see Jack Johnson get a flogging. They went away disappointed. There were two guys in the audience who were different. And they were these two guys, two Aboriginal men. Fred Maynard and Tom Lacey. These two guys had slipped under the radar of the then Aborigines Protection Act and were surreptitiously working on the Sydney waterfront as wharf labourers. Also, equally remarkably at the time, given again the White Australia policy and the Sydney being a strong bastion of white supremacy, also on the Sydney waterfront at the time was an organisation called the Coloured Progressive Association. The Coloured Progressive Association consisted of African-American, West Indian sailors who would come into Sydney, slip under the radar, work for a little while on the docks, and then move on. But this organisation, the Coloured Progressive Association, had attracted these two Aboriginal men as members. And at the time that Jack Johnson left Australia, the Coloured Progressive Association had organised a farewell party for Jack Johnson. And this is actually a photograph of that function. Those of you who are old enough, as old as me and Gwyn, will remember the notorious scandal rag in Melbourne, the Melbourne Truth. The Melbourne Truth described this particular function as a coon's corroboree, in keeping with the times. But this photograph is very interesting, folks, because the man up the back, the man up the back in the light suit, that's Jack Johnson. And sitting there is Fred Maynard, one of those two Aboriginal wharf labourers. This means that Maynard and Lacey got to meet Jack Johnson. Now, the equivalent of that in more recent times would be when Muhammad Ali visited the Aboriginal Health Service in Fitzroy. Brownie over there remembers. And that was quite an inspirational moment for a lot of Aboriginal people in Melbourne, including me and Brownie and some of the others here who met him. Well, the same deal was happening back then when Jack Johnson, Fred Maynard and Tom Lacey met Jack Johnson. He was an enormous inspiration to him. And so Maynard and Lacey continued their association with the Coloured Progressive Association on the Sydney waterfront, which in turn, over a period of time, led them to being exposed to the ideas to do with Pan-Africanism and Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, one of the important, well, considered the father of international black nationalism, one of the really important people in anti-colonial history. And Marcus Garvey, in 1914, set up his own international organisation called the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And Marcus Garvey, when he set this organisation up, said to himself in 1914, he said, I want to spread these ideas of mine around the globe. How do I do that? If he was here today, I'd say, Marcus, get on the internet here and you can go around the globe, mate. However, this may come as a surprise to some of you young people, back in 1914, there was no internet, And so Marcus Garvey had the problem of thinking to himself, well, how the fuck do I get these ideas around the world? And he thought to himself, what goes around the world? And he answered himself, sailors. So he made a point of recruiting African, West Indian and African American sailors into his organization. And he said to these sailors, wherever your ship calls into port, anywhere in the world, set up a local branch of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And so it was, folks, that by 1920, there were branches of Marcus Garvey's organization all over the world, including in Sydney, Australia. And who were two of the inaugural members of Marcus Garvey's organization in Sydney? Fred Maynard and Tom Lacey, who were strongly influenced by the ideas of Marcus Garvey about the importance of colonized people developing their own political and economic independence, you know? And so these two guys fueled up on the ideas of being espoused by Marcus Garvey, went on to put these ideas into practice by creating the first modern Aboriginal political organisation, the Australian Aborigines Progressive Association. The Progressive Association, as you can see, it was clearly influenced by Marcus Garvey and Marcus Garvey's ideas. At the time, and for many decades after, Anglo-Australian historians had always said that the AAPA had been set up and influenced by white Christian missionaries. And they based that, these lazy historians, based that on the motto, One God, One Aim, One Destiny, which was Marcus Garvey's motto for his UNEA. But these lazy historians attributed that to white Christian missionaries. How could these black fellows in Australia set up anything without the help of the good white Christian missionaries? Which was a complete and absolute lie. And that lie persisted for decades before a man, one of my great friends these days, Professor John Maynard from University of Newcastle, similar academic trajectory to me, went to university late in life, studied history, did his PhD writing the true story of his grandfather, who was Fred Maynard, you know? And the other connection between the AAPA and today and me, the most radical branch of the AAPA was in a place called Nambucca Heads on the north coast of New South Wales. And it was my great-grandfather who was the secretary of that particular branch. As you can see, I went and had a yarn with him there a few years ago. He didn't have much to say, but I had a few things to say to him. So, that's the end of part one, Faith. I just all take a 5 minute break, and when, or 5 or 10 minute break, get yourself a cup of coffee. When we come back, I'm going to give you a rave about the next significant moment in my mind that happened politically for Aboriginal Australia, and that was the emergence of the Black Power movement in Redfern, Fitzroy, and South Brisbane in the late 1960s.
And sitting here makes me feel really connected to a movement, to a struggle that has been going on for much longer than me. I feel like I'm not just shouting into the wind anymore. I feel like I'm making some progress, however small that is. And I hope that you guys are feeling the same. So please, give it up for part two with Professor Gary Fowler.
Okay, flattery will get you everywhere, folks. This second part of today, it's going to be a lightning trip through what I argue is the most significant movement of the 20th century in terms of the change that it brought and the long-term effects of it, even though sadly, most of the people who you're going to see in some of these clips and that are no longer with us. I'm not sure how come I've managed to sort of stay alive this long. So many really good, strong, staunch people who I've worked with over the years, not only are not no longer with us, but too many of them died extremely young, you know, ridiculously young. Well, as you'll see, most of us who were involved in the movement you're about to look at now, we're all impossibly young. I mean, you're probably lucky that we were so young that we were fearless. We didn't seem to realise, you know, how dangerous some of the things we were doing was. But let's just get on with it. I'm going to start in 1965. 1965, I'm sure it's a year you all remember very well. At least a couple of us here remember it anyway. In 1965, I was living in my beautiful Gumbanja homelands, folks.
This, folks, is my beautiful Gumbanja homeland. As you can see, it, midwinter, is subtropical paradise. And the question for you, as students, is why? Why would a man like me, who comes from a place like this, spend 46 consecutive winters in Melbourne, folks? That is the question. However, a clue to the answer of that question rests in this here photograph.
Now, that's a little unfair of me. Not all of my classmates grew up to be rednecks, just most of them. But this here photo tells you several things about Australia in 1965. Like I said, one little black fella in this class. Now, what's significant about that is, as I said in the last talk, Aboriginal people are relatively thin on the ground in Victoria, largely courtesy thanks to the massacres and the genocide that occurred in this part of Australia. However, where I come from, Gumbanja land, that country I just showed you, the Nambucca Valley, my people managed to survive the initial invasion and occupation of our homeland relatively well compared to perhaps down this way, to the extent that by 1965, when this photograph was taken, the Gumbanja people still made up almost a quarter of the local population in the three towns along the Nambucca River Valley. There was Nambucca Heads, which you saw at the river mouth there. 7 miles up the river was Maxwell, where the high school was. A further 13 miles up the road was a place called Bowerville. Those three towns served this particular high school. So the Gumbanja people, we made up more, at least a quarter of the local population in 1965. And yet, in Maxwell High School, which served the entire valley, there are only three or four Aboriginal kids in that entire high school. Now, what that says to you, that is an illustration of the extent to which Aboriginal people were still, more than halfway through the 20th century, still being systematically and deliberately, and in parts by government policy, being denied meaningful educational opportunities. And that's an illustration of how that was occurring. I was only in this class and at this high school because some well-intentioned white people considered me worthy of a scholarship. And that's the only reason I was in that class at that school. So that's one of the things that this photograph tells you about this school. Another thing that it tells you, during the week in class at this school, I could sit next to any of these people in the classroom. However, on a Saturday night at the local picture theatre, which was the only form of entertainment for young 15-year-olds like us in a little country town like Nambucca Heads, the only form of entertainment available in 1965 was the local pictures on a Saturday night, where you'd go along and watch the latest in American cultural imperialist rubbish. But nevertheless, when I went to the pictures on a Saturday night, I could never sit next to any of my fellow students in this class. Why? Because the picture theatre was segregated. There was a roped off section down the front, in front of the rope was where the blacks had to sit, and up the back of the picture theatre with all the good seats was where all the white kids got to sit. So that's another thing this tells you about Australia then. This was the era of segregation. Another thing this photograph tells you about Australia at the time, this is more than halfway through the 20th century. This is 64 years after the White Australia policy was created and established. And still, 64 years later, the White Australia policy is well and truly functioning. You won't see any non-Anglo people in that class except me. That's the sort of Australia that I grew up in. Not only was it a very white country, all of these kids in my class, they didn't think of themselves as Australians. They thought of themselves as British. Australia was still a very British place then. So this was the era of the White Australia policy. So there's three simple things that this picture tells you about Australia then. I said that the picture theatre was segregated. Within months of this photograph being taken, that was to change. And it was to change because of this man. This man, Charlie Perkins, was about to graduate at Sydney University. Many people believe that Charlie Perkins was the first Aboriginal university graduate in Australia in 1965. Let me tell you something. The first Native American university graduate was in the 1850s. The first Canadian Native university graduate was in the 1840s. The first African American university graduate was even earlier. The first Maori from Aotearoa, the land of the wrong white crowd, the first Maori university graduate was a good 100 years before the first Aboriginal university graduate, which again tells you, says to you, or illustrates to you the extent to which Aboriginal people were still, more than halfway through the 20th century, being systematically denied educational opportunities. Charlie Perkins was not the first Aboriginal university graduate. The first Aboriginal university graduate, you will remember in the last talk, the second slide I showed you, I said that the Goombangia people were the best looking and the smartest black fellows in Australia. The proof is in the pudding, folks. The first Aboriginal University graduate in Australia was a Goombangia woman. The second Aboriginal University graduate in Australia was Charlie Perkins. But both of those people graduated a good 100 years after other Indigenous peoples in other parts of the comparable world, in comparable societies to Australia. So again, an illustration of that. Now, Charlie Perkins, around the time this photo was taken, took up an idea that we'd seen in Australia in 1961 when an exercise conducted by the African-American Civil Rights Movement, the Freedom Rides, occurred. Charlie Perkins decided in 1965 that it was time to have a freedom ride in Australia. And he rounded up, he was a member of a student group at Sydney University called Student Action for Aborigines. And they decided to take a little bus trip into the north of New South Wales, into some of the most notoriously racist little areas of the state at the time, and challenge the bigots, challenge the segregation, challenge the racism in these little country towns. So they rented a bus. There's a state-of-the-art 1965 bus. They stupidly put a big sign along the side of it saying Student Action for Aborigines, which was guaranteed to attract every redneck and Nazi on the road that I encountered, which it did, and off they went. And this is where they went. They took off west of Sydney, going north into some of, like I said, some of the more notoriously racist places. Places like Walgett, Brewarrina, Moree, and places like this. And everywhere they went, they went up north and then across to the coast and then down the coast. And everywhere they went, there were young Aboriginal kids, my generation, 15, 16 years old, young people like me, watching very closely what was going on. Because what happened, what impressed the likes of me and other people like me, my age, around the state, which I found out a few years later when I met people from other parts of the state when I moved to Sydney, I realised that we were all watching very closely because this was the first time in my lifetime that I'd ever seen a black fella stand up against the local bigots and the Ku Klux Klanners in some of these towns and walk away alive. So this left a deep, deep impression on the likes of me, my generation. It had a very powerful impact on me. In 1966, a year later, I had 1 year to go in high school. I was going very well. I was a smart little black fella. And at the end of 1966, the headmaster called me up. I had 1 year to go to matriculate. Headmaster called me up to his office and he said to me, "Foley, don't come back next year." And I was a little perplexed and I inquired politely as to why. And these are the very words he said to me. He said, "We don't want your kind here." And with those words, he expelled me. Now, in expelling me, he severely affected my self-esteem, my self-confidence, but worst of all, he destroyed my belief in education. He destroyed my belief in education to the point where it was 30 years before somebody at Melbourne Uni insulted me enough to make me think that I could do it. I could have done it from the beginning. Had I gone to university in my early days, I could have got advantage of the free education, free university education that Gough Whitlam gave us. Instead, I waited 30 years and I ended up with a huge hex debt, like a lot of you probably got. Right? So, as soon as I got expelled, I thought to myself, fuck this, I'm getting out of this little racist arsehole of a town and I'm heading to the big smoke. And I moved to Sydney. And as soon as I got to Sydney, well, hang on, we'll go back a bit. As soon as I got to Sydney, I discovered the traditional welcome to Sydney for young blackfellas from the bush. A welcome provided by the New South Wales Constabulary. This building here in 1967 was the Regent Street Police Station, just near Central Railway in Sydney. And it was inside this building in 1967. I'd only been in Sydney for 2 weeks and I was grabbed by a couple of thug coppers from the notorious New South Wales Police 21 Division, who gave me a good flogging in here, which served apparently as my welcome to Sydney. But it really pissed me off to such an extent, you'll find out a little bit more of that later. I'm going to go back a bit for a moment. And at the time, the older generation in Sydney were worried about us younger generation encountering these sort of racist coppers and that in the streets of Redfern. And to try and keep us off the streets, I suppose, people like Faith Bandler and others encouraged young people like me. They said, get involved in this campaign for this referendum. Because they said to us, if we can get a yes vote, then things will change for our people. And it's probably the last time I ever believed any of my elders. But I did believe her, and Faith was one of the early inspirations for me. And I'll let Faith tell you what the referendum was all about.
The fairest thing for the Commonwealth government to do is perhaps hold a referendum. The Aboriginal people lived under six different laws. Each state had its own law. We needed the state laws to be abolished for this reason, that they created such tremendous confusion. You could be a relatively free person walking around Victoria and you come to New South Wales and you find you've got to go up to Bridge Street in Sydney to get permission if you can go and see your uncle or aunt, if you please. Then if you move over the border into Queensland, well, the very fact that you go over the border into Queensland, you could be arrested without reason. So there was a great need to abolish those state laws and to bring everyone under the common law, the federal law. So that is the main reason why it was important to have a referendum. We had to change the federal constitution.
And change the constitution they did, folks. The 1967 referendum result is still, to this day, the biggest yes vote in Australian history. In excess of 90% of the Australian people voted yes to a question that they understood to mean, do you support justice for Aboriginal people, yes or no? And despite the biggest yes vote in Australian history, nothing changed. It failed to change anything, you know? And if I might just mention a more recent referendum. I predicted a year out from the recent referendum that it was gonna get a no vote. And I didn't have to be a clairvoyant to figure that out. All you needed was a little understanding of recent history. And if you understood recent history, then you'd know that after the great success of the Aboriginal 10 Embassy movement in which you're going to see a little of in a little while, in 1972, we saw the beginnings of the white backlash. The white backlash took many forms over the years. In the beginning, it was, not long after, it was Pauline Hanson and One Nation come along and tried to justify the sort of racism that she was advocating. Then we had 40 years of history and culture wars, where in the 1970s, for the first time, a small number of Australian historians began to write about the Aboriginal experience of Australian history, and that prompted an almost immediate backlash in academia and in the Murdoch tabloids and the Murdoch television stations and things, that resulted in 40 years of arguments over were there massacres, were there not, all this sort of stuff, Keith Windschuttle, and the whole sort of history and culture wars. 40 years that went on. Then along comes Native Title, and immediately the Australian mining industry pours tens of millions of dollars into vicious anti-Aboriginal racist public relations campaigns, multi-million dollar campaigns across all mediums, newspapers, television, you name it. And so after 40 or 50 years of that sort of vicious racist propaganda, anti-Aboriginal propaganda, some idiot decides, oh, let's have a referendum, you know. And any idiot who knew anything about history knew that to have a referendum in 2022 on an issue to do with Aborigines was completely destined for failure, bringing upon all of us the sort of result that we got, which we're still seeing the effects of in the last 2 days.
Anzac Day.
And beyond. You know, we're going to see it for a long time to come. But that's all thanks to the idiots in the Aboriginal movement who decided it was a good idea to hold a referendum. And they should be challenged on that idea. It's them who fucked up that the situation today. But we're moving on, folks. I digress. By the time I hit Sydney, Charlie Perkins by then had moved to Sydney. Well, he was in Sydney, but he'd created a new organisation called the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs, which was basically a welfare sort of an organisation, but it became an important meeting place for young Aboriginal people like me, fresh from the bush. For the first time, a lot of us of my generation, when we hit Sydney, when we arrived in Sydney, we were meeting other young Aboriginal people like ourselves from different parts of the country, and we were able to share for the first time our experiences and talk to each other about what our experiences had been growing up in different parts of the state. And one of the important areas where we were meeting each other was the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs, run by Charlie Perkins. Because on a Friday and Saturday night, they used to have dances for us young mob, and it was a good opportunity to meet beautiful young Aboriginal women, among other things. Men, whatever it was your go, it was a good opportunity to meet others like yourself and to share experiences and knowledge.
The Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs.
The foundation was sort of like the lifeblood of all of us, because the majority of us came from the country, and the old welfare board system was sort of closing down, and that's the reason why the foundation was established, to help people coming from the country to the city, to establish them in jobs and housing and all other social things that they could help Aboriginal people with. And the foundation used to be always, there was always a meeting going on there. There was always a group of Aboriginal people in there. And that's where we used to go, and just about every young person at that particular point in time.
The foundation was an organisation. Okay, they said it was a non-sectarian and non-political. But I tell you what, there was a lot of politics in it as well.
The Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs played a crucial role as the crucible, if you like,
that nurtured the great move and push for Aboriginal community control and Aboriginal economic independence.
It taught people to stand up and be counted, really. You couldn't help it. With the likes of me, Charlie Perkins there.
The thing about the 67 referendum, that it did change things. The New South Wales state government apparently realised that the writing was on the wall for their assimilationist system when the result of the referendum came in. And as a result, the New South Wales state government arbitrarily, overnight, closed down the old apartheid system that had existed for about 80 years. And in doing so, in closing down the so-called reserves, the concentration camps around the state, they pulled the rug out from under 50,000 Aboriginal people in the rural areas who were left with no support, no nothing. And that resulted in a mass exodus from the rural areas of New South Wales into the inner city. When I moved to Redfern at the end of 1966, the Aboriginal population of Redfern was around 1,500 people or so, a really small community. Redfern was the slums in Sydney. That was the only place where Aboriginal people coming in from the bush could find any sort of accommodation. And as a result, once the state government closed down the reserves, there was this mass exodus from the rural areas into Redfern. So that within 3 years of me moving to Redfern, the population had gone from about 1,500 to nearly 35,000 people. It was and remains to this day the biggest Aboriginal community that's ever existed in the history of Australia. 35,000 Aboriginal people, virtually everybody in that community. The thing we had in common was poverty. The thing we had in common, well, you know, like I said to you before, there was no black bourgeoisie back then. You know, that was a more recent phenomenon. And the one thing everybody had in common was poverty. And the other thing we had in common, especially if you were young, you were being brutalized and harassed and intimidated on the streets by coppers, no matter where you went. And that was what began the next phase. In 1969, the term black power suddenly hits the Australian landscape. And it hit the Australian landscape at an incident that occurred in Northcote, just near Westgar Station, which is where the Aboriginal Advancement League was at the time. And it was largely because of these two guys, Bob Mazza and Bruce McGuinness. Bob Mazza was the chairman of the board of the Aboriginal Advancement League at the time. Bruce was the director. And these two guys invited an otherwise obscure Caribbean academic by the name of Roosevelt Brown, Professor Roosevelt Brown, to do a talk at the league. The talk, Roosevelt Brown titled Black Power. And what he meant by black power and what he was talking about was the importance, again, like Marcus Garvey, he was talking about the importance of all colonised peoples in the world to strive towards their own economic and political independence. That's what he meant by black power, and that's what he was talking about. However, the inimitable Australian media at the time, and there's Roosevelt Brown, I mean, as you can see, there wasn't a lot of people at this meeting, and half of the people there were media. And Roosevelt Brown naturally talked to the local media, and in their inimitable style, the Melbourne media decides, instead of talking about the issues as Roosevelt Brown had discussed them, decided to sensationalise the whole thing and come up with headlines like this, which scared the shit out of all the genteel white people of Melbourne. And suddenly black power was on on the agenda, so people thought. Meanwhile, up in Redfern, there's Solly Blair, who had one of the best afros in Redfern at the time. In Redfern, a black power movement emerges. Now, the black power movement largely came about because of these factors. Charlie Perkins' Freedom Ride, like I said, had a dramatic impact on my generation. And it made us aware that it was possible to stand up for your rights and get away with it. It also I'm just going to guess what I've got written up there. Among the, it was also prompted by the police harassment of what was happening in Redfern. And as luck would have it, in 1967-68 in Sydney, Sydney was awash with Yank soldiers. The American army, who were being shot up by Ho Chi Minh and his mates in Vietnam, were looking for somewhere safe for their troops to go on R&R, rest and recuperation. And Sydney seemed to be the only place in the Southern Hemisphere where the American military thought it was safe for their troops to go on rest and recuperation. So suddenly Sydney is awash with Yank soldiers. And of those Yank soldiers, we observed that a significant number of them were African Americans being used as cannon fodder. And a lot of these African Americans, when they arrived in Sydney, one of the first things they said was, where's the black community? There was no black community in Sydney, except for us. And so some of them started coming over and visiting us and encountering us. And these American, African American soldiers brought with them three things. They also brought the latest in African American political literature, and they also brought with them their own personal accounts of what was going on in their communities back home, what was happening in the ghettos of Oakland and other places around America. And they were able to talk to us firsthand about some of the events that were going on there, and they knew people in the Black Panther Party and these other activities that we were very interested in what was going on, because in the process of us trying to figure out, I mean, the Black Power movement in Redfern really began when me and Paul Cohen, Gary Williams, got together and decided to, in the naivety of our youth, decided that we wanted to do something about these coppers harassing us on the streets of Redfern all the time. And so we looked at the experience of others in the world. We looked particularly at what was going on in Oakland, California, with the Black Panther Party there, the programs they were setting up, the legal aid stuff, the community food programs, the Breakfast for Kids programs, all of these sorts of things. We saw what was happening in Oakland as being almost identical to what was happening to us in Redfern. And so we stole some of their ideas, adapted and adopted these ideas to the Redfern thing situation. So that we thought, well, if we're going to counter the coppers, the first thing we need to do is mount a spying operation on the cops. We mounted our own surveillance operation against the coppers in Redfern. And we started gathering information about what they were doing, who they were arresting, where they were taking them, gathering piles of information constantly. We went out into the streets armed with pens and notebooks. And for our troubles, we got bashed by the coppers more than once along the way, but in no time at all, we'd gathered enough information about what the coppers were doing for us to think, okay, what do we do with all this info? Now, by then, the only person we knew of any consequence in society was the Dean of the Law Faculty at the University of New South Wales, Professor Wooten. And we only knew him because Paul Coe became his first Aboriginal student in his law school. And so he loved Paul Coe, you know, his good little Aboriginal boy in his class. And so we went to Professor Wooten with all this information we'd gathered, and we dumped it on his desk and we said, we'll come back in a few days, we want you to read this. And we went back in a few days, and Professor Wooden, remember, he's a man of the law. He looked at the stuff we'd showed him, and he was shocked. He said, I find it difficult to believe that this sort of stuff's happening in New South Wales in 1972. And we said, well, Prof, there's one way you can find out for yourself. Come over to Redfern. We're only joking, because we thought there's no way this conservative old bastard's going to come to Redfern. No white fellas had come to Redfern in those days. But he said, yes. So we thought, well. So we said, come to the Empress Hotel on a Saturday night. Now remember, Professor, this is one of the roughest pubs in Sydney. So please come dressed casual. His idea of coming dressed casual was he had his sports coat with his cravat and all his he said, take that thing off around your neck, you know, brush up your hair a bit, sit in the corner and watch. And I had to get a couple of our brothers to keep an eye on him, because we didn't want any of the blackfellas rolling him, you know. And sure enough, the coppers came in and they started their usual trick on a Friday night. They came in about 9:45 in numbers. They'd form a flying wedge, come into the pub, start grabbing people, pushing them back out through a tunnel of coppers into the wagons waiting at the front. And they were doing their usual performance, and I was watching old Professor Wooden, and suddenly I saw him get up and start to walk towards these coppers. And I ran over and said, what are you doing? He said, I'm going to go and intervene. I said, no, you're not. We don't want you locked up. You're going to just sit there and watch. He was shocked. He couldn't believe what he'd seen. And the week later, we had a meeting with him. He said, what do we do? And we said, what are you talking about? You're the man of the law. You tell us. But then Paul Coe piped up and he said, well, Prof, I've read that in America, some young volunteer lawyers got together and set up these free shopfront legal aid centres. He said, why can't we do that here in Redfern? And Professor Wooden proceeded to tell Paul Coe all the 100 reasons why you couldn't do it in Australia. 6 weeks later, we opened the doors of the first Aboriginal legal service in Australia. I'm getting mixed up here as we go. These are some of the inspirations for the Black Power movement. First and foremost was people from our own communities, people who we considered heroes in our historical path. Jackie Patton, Bill Owners, Pearl Gibbs, 1930s, 40s activists, them top three. Don Brady. We knew Don Brady. Gladys Elphick from South Australia. Dooley Binbin, one of the founders of the 1946 Pilbara strike. And Vincent Lingiari, one of the greatest Aboriginal leaders of the 20th century. We also were very impressed by this bloke. When I first met Paul Coe said to me, I told him about what had happened with me and the coppers, and then he told me what had happened with him and the coppers, and he handed me a book, which was this book. He said, read this. When I read this, this was the second part of my politicisation. I became politicised when the coppers gave me that bashing and when I read this book. And this is why we love Malcolm.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
That's why we love Malcolm. We're also into France Fanon. I still recommend people who want to know anything about colonialism, read France Fanon to this day. Another person who we're really interested in, James Baldwin, another African-American writer. George Jackson, who got murdered in Soledad Prison. We also were very big on the American Indian movement, and Vine DeLauria wrote this book, but I also loved this book. This was the first book that I read that made me realise that Native American people hate anthropologists just as much as we do. Of course, we liked We love what was going on in Vietnam. We love Ho Chi Minh kicking the ass of not only the Yanks but all of his lapdog Australian allies, you know. And that great Aboriginal revolutionary Mao Zedong. Also, you know, a lot of the African leaders. Because at the same time, remember, in the 50s and 60s was the big era of decolonization, especially in Africa. And there was we met a lot of the future leaders of some African nations because they were studying at Australian universities. And so we got to meet and find out a hell of a lot about what was going on in Africa and Asia about with decolonization as well. And of course, we loved the Black Panther Party. And the imagery of the Black Panther Party was created by this guy who, thanks to my brother Richard Bell from Brisbane, Richard Bell managed to enable me to meet one of my great heroes was Emery Douglas, Minister for Culture of the Black Panther Party. And I actually got to meet him in, 2009 when he came out. These days he's an internationally famous artist. And it was great meeting him and sharing, being able to tell him how much I'd admired him back in the day. The other mob we were very big on was the American Indian movement, in particular Russell Means and Dennis Banks. And again, I mean, you know, and I got to say, for those of you who know, Leonard Peltier was released recently, finally, after 50 fucking years, 50 years, you know. And the leader of the American Indian Movement at the time of the siege at Wounded Knee was Russell Means, who just before he died, I mean, back in the day, he was one of my biggest heroes. And just before he died, I actually got to meet the man himself. In fact, I met him at a conference in Adelaide where I gave a talk in which he featured, and he was sitting in the front row. Listen to me, I mean, it's the only time I've ever been nervous talking to an audience. But he was just, he was exactly the man I'd always understood him and believed him to be. And it was, this is probably the greatest moment of my life, actually meeting this man who'd been such a hero to me for all those years. And he passed away not long after this, sadly. Black Power also was about restoring Aboriginal people's self-esteem. When a society tells you that you're a worthless piece of shit for 100 years or so, it can affect your mind. And so it's important, you know, we felt it was important in the Black Power movement to restore the dignity and self-respect of our own mob. And like I said, Paul Coe was one of the key men in the, well, he was the main person in the early stages of the Black Power movement in Redmond. This is why.
Economic sanctions passed against Australia. There should be sporting ties should be severed, cultural ties should be severed. We have got to work towards the ultimate objective, and that we are economically, culturally and socially independent. Land rights is a means to this.
In present society, this offers nothing for black people. It only offers now police oppression, constant ridicule, kids die from malnutrition, we get constant racist, you know, sort of derogative marks in schools, we get sort of institutionalized race in the form of the education syllabus where black people are taught to think of themselves as Jackie. There is no positive sort of image of black people in this society because it's run by the controlled or used by the white media. Now we want to change all this.
And change all this we did, folks. The Black Power movement stood for three things, basically. Self-determination, the basic right of all peoples to determine their own destiny. Economic and political independence. Economic independence was seen as the path towards genuine political independence. And land rights was important because we saw land as an economic base from which to build our own economic independence. It was simple as that. Like I said, we created the first free shopfront legal aid centre in Australia, Redfern Aboriginal Medical Centre. We introduced the concept of free legal aid into the Australian context. A couple of years later, Gough Whitlam came along, became Prime Minister, and introduced universal free legal aid. 10 years later, another filthy scumbag Labor government of Bob Hawke and Bob Hawke came along and took it off us. Gough Whitlam gave us free university education, and it was fucking Bob Hawke and his lump of filth Labor government that took it off us and gave all you mob and me our hex debt. But we won't go into that today. Within 6 months of us opening the first legal service, the reigning matriarch of Redfern, a very strong, powerful woman who was the aunt of Paul Coe, a woman called Mum Shirl Smith, she summoned us young activists, and when Mum Shirl summoned you, you did what you were told. She was a tough person. And so we went along to this meeting with her, and she said to us, "Listen, you punks, this community has enormous health problems." She said, "Why can't we set up a free shopfront medical service like you set up the legal service down there?" And we said, "Oh, okay, let's have a go." So we called a meeting, and as luck would have it, to that first meeting came this mad pipe-smoking, mountain-climbing, communist eye doctor called Fred Hollows. And Mum Shell put it on Fred. She said, "Fred, why can't we open an Aboriginal community health clinic?" And Fred Hollows proceeded to tell Mum Shell all 50 reasons why it couldn't be done in Australia. And again, a few weeks later, we opened the doors of the first free shopfront Aboriginal medical service in Australia. Now, the sad thing is, this photograph, I took this photograph back when we opened the doors of the place, and the intent was I wanted to show the generation for whom we were creating these things, these revolutionary organisations. These were a bunch of the young kids from the Redfern community who were younger than us. And the really sad thing is, within 20 years, the majority of those kids were dead. You know? And again, that's an example of the discrepancy in life expectancy for Aboriginal people. When I turned 50, the Aboriginal life expectancy for an Aboriginal male was about 46. Now that I'm about to turn 75, the average life expectancy for an Aboriginal adult male is 71. So I'm up 2 years. Another idea that we stole from the Black Panther Party was the Breakfast for Children program. And the Breakfast for Children program, we adopted and adapted for the simple reason that the problems that they were seeing in the Oakland, California community were exactly the same as we were seeing in Redfern. Kids going to school with no breakfast, which affects their ability to concentrate, which affects their education, so on and so forth. So we set up a Breakfast for Kids program, and the first week we ran it, we borrowed a mobile kitchen, caravan kitchen from the Wayside Chapel at King's Cross, and the blokes of the Black Power movement, thinking we're big men, you know, we'll run this. Only took a half a day of chaos when all of the black kids not only turned up wanting a feed, they brought all their poor white mates with them. And you know, these young white kids from the slums were just as hungry as the black kids. We weren't gonna turn them away. And so we found up having trying to feed all these mob of kids, and the women who were standing back watching us eventually said, "All right, you blokes, piss off. Get out of the road." And they took it over and they turned it into what eventually became the Morrowena Aboriginal Women and Children's Centre in Redfern. But here's this bit of footage I'm about to show you is from a 1972 Four Corners program. But I want you to listen to the voice of the reporter. He's very British, and you needed to sound like this if you were going to get a job with the ABC in Australia in 1972, because like I said, Australia was still very British. But here's a little thing that'll give you an idea of what we were doing in Redfern at the time.
There are several other examples of an emerging initiative and independence, self-help and self-knowledge. All those enterprises are based in Sydney, most of them in fact here in Redfern, an inner city suburb. They were all organised by the Aboriginal people themselves. The leaders, the activists, are mostly young, and they're a group only in an informal sense, but put together, their views give quite a coherent picture. Frustration, impatience, and anger. Race relations may not loom very large as a problem for these children. Not yet. But hunger does. The breakfast project on the edge of Redfern was a self-help scheme started earlier this year by young Aboriginal activists. They had the idea to help children who were getting too little food or the wrong kind of food. Self-help through schemes like the Breakfast Project and the Legal and Medical Services, is an attempt by the activists to get Aborigines moving, to find the confidence to help themselves. This is one of the things they mean by black power. But according to Mr. Gary Foley, a black theatre actor, they mean other things too.
Black power means the economic independence to enable black people to be able to determine their own destinies.
Well, have you and the young militant radicals who work with you in Redfern, given away altogether the idea of working through the system, you know, the usual channels?
Well, I gave most of it away a long, long time ago. I don't believe that we're really going to get anything through working through the system in this country, because, you know, the system isn't geared for what we're asking for.
The arid heartland of the Australian city is the scene of the black activist. That's because the big city is the only place where Aborigines can learn at close quarters how the white system works, how to use it, and for some of them, how to confront it. They're in a hurry, certain that they've been badly done by, and rather aggressive.
There you go, Frank. Another idea we stole from America, Bob Mazza, after the incident at the Aborigines Banking League, Mazza and McGuinness and a couple other people went to a Black Power conference in Atlanta, Georgia, and on the way back from America, Bob Mazza called into Harlem and went and visited the Harlem Black Theatre and came back with the idea that we needed a similar sort of political theatre set up in Australia.
Black theatre in Australia is a new, a reawakening within the black movement. I feel that it is the cultural spearhead of this particular movement. One could say it's a black renaissance.
This is from ABC TV, 73.
You know what? In the long run, I reckon we'd be better off with a more restrictive immigration policy.
That's a clip from the National Black Theatre, which Bob Mazza conned me into being part of. We did a legendary show called Basically Black at the Nimrod Theatre in Sydney. We actually put the Nimrod Theatre in its financial feet. We were the first show that ever made money from it. But afterwards, the ABC approached us and said they were interested in doing a series based on the stage show. And so they decided to do a pilot, and this was part of the pilot. But the ABC was so horrified by what we came up with that not only did they not proceed with the series, the ABC did not touch black comedy again for another 40 years. And that's part of the reason why. It was fun, man. Now we shift to Brisbane for a moment, just for Gwen to have a look at. In Brisbane, a much more radical outfit emerged in the form of Dennis Walker's Black Panther Party.
Black Panthers were on the rise in the United States of America. They seem to be doing good things. They seem to be able to feed their communities. They seem to be able to house them. They seem to be able to look after them. So we thought, why not start a prison chapter here? And we did. Everyone has a right to defend themselves if it is an aggressive opponent. And it is inhuman. It's the one person's human rights. If you get a gun to one man, and then give them all.
Took a revived Aboriginal dignity in directions that surprised even themselves.
And I think we've got a whole lot of eyes on us right throughout the world. I think what we've got to do now is organise on a very broad front around black issues and really do something. And
that's Dennis and his comrades, some of them. 1971 was a year of significant change. I'm going to zip through here. We had our first ever Aboriginal member of federal parliament. Ironically, an extreme conservative member of the Liberal Party of Queensland, put in place by Joe Bjelke-Petersen. Some of you young people, if you don't know, never heard of Joe Bjelke-Petersen, go and look him up. Look up Neville Bonner. Gove Land Rights case reaffirmed terra nullius. Vincent Lingiari came south to meet up with activists of the Black Power movement. Lynn Otis set up one of the early land rights claims in Sherbrooke Forest. Didn't last very long because he got firebombed by neo-Nazis. He's lucky to get out alive. And then this happened in 1971, and I can tell you about this because I was there at the birth of this. This came about after a demonstration in Adelaide that I spoke at, after which a man called Harold Thomas, who was a mate of mine, he was working in the South Australian Museum at the time, and he and I, after the demonstration, went back to his place. On the way, we dropped into the Arkabar Hotel and purchased two slabs of EB, adjourned to his place and proceeded to demolish the aforementioned two slabs. And in the process, we were lamenting the fact that the new, what we regarded as the newly emerging national pan-Aboriginal movement that we were part of, didn't have some sort of unifying symbol. So, you know, again, with the arrogance of youth, we decided we'd do something about it, and Harold, being the artist, whips out his artist gear and starts fiddling with a range of designs and ended up with this. And the original version of this was supposed to be, that's Harold, the original version was that the black was supposed to represent the people, the red was supposed to represent the land, supposed to be red ochre colour, the line where the black and the red met was supposed to be symbolic of the close relationship between the people and the land, and overlooking the people and the land and protecting them is the sun, the giver of the life. So folks, you now know what most people in Australia don't know, and that is that this is a two-slab flag. Moving on. So towards the end of 1971, the Black Power movement was on a roll. We were having a lot of fun. There's Dennis declaring war on whites. And these sort of headlines were hitting the newspapers regularly. And ironically, another little ironic twist of the old days, when Rupert Murdoch first created the Australian newspaper, it was rabidly pro-Aboriginal land rights. And it wasn't till Gough Whitlam got in that Murdoch did his abrupt turn to the right, where he ended up to this day. So these sort of headlines were constantly in the newspapers towards the end of 71, and in Canberra the Prime Minister and a tragic little man by the name of Billy McMahon was getting more and more nervous all the time. But then, I mean, even in Darwin, I mean, the rednecks who ran the Northern Territory in those days, as distinct from the rednecks who run the Northern Territory these days, the rednecks back in the day used to say, oh, our Abbos up here in the Northern Territory, they'd never behave like those radical scum down south. No, our Abbos are not like that. So the Northern Territory rednecks got a shock when the Larrakia people bunged on this demo in the main street of Darwin. On the occasion, to make it even more embarrassing for the redneck, on the occasion of a visit to Darwin by one of the obscure members of British aristocracy, I think it was Princess Margaret or somebody. So, and another interesting thing about this demonstration, in the immediate aftermath of this, I found in my archive a letter from a man by the name of Keith Windschuttle, expressing strong support for what had been done and giving them a major donation. That went over the head of most years. But go and find out who Keith Windschuttle was. I mentioned him earlier as one of the architects of the history and culture wars for 40 years. This is before that. This is when he was still a lefty. The big event of 71 was the Springbok Tour. The tour of Australia by the white racist rugby players from South Africa. This was a boom for us because suddenly in Redfern, we discovered in the lead up to the tour coming to Australia, we discovered that there was a bunch of Australians who called themselves anti-racist. Now this was news to us in Redfern. And so Paul Coe jumped up at one of their early demonstrations before the Springboks got to Australia and challenged the anti-racists. He said, how is it that you people are coming out in these sort of numbers protesting against racism halfway around the world? Why aren't you marching with us in support of our Aboriginal land rights marching? Mm. Now the anti-racist people, to their credit, took Coe's proposition seriously, and they, as a result, started coming to our land rights demonstrations, which increased the numbers, which made our demos much bigger and much better and had a much more big impact. And so we were able to join in the anti-apartheid demos, and that's that notorious image of me taken out the front of the Squire Inn in Bondi Junction, where the South African rugby players were ensconced at the time. And even that image has gone beyond that. This is Richard Bell with a mural in Brisbane somewhere of the same thing. But then, folks, right at the end of 1971, December, this happened. Now, I put it to you. If I said that today, I would be rendered in an orange jumpsuit to Guantanamo Bay. Right? And this is the Australian newspaper here. This is a broadsheet. That's how big that headline was. And I feel compelled to offer a quick explanation of this because I don't want you to get the wrong idea. Some of you are old enough will remember this journalist, Simon Townsend. Simon Townsend in the 1960s was one of Australia's, long before he had that terrible children's show and his dog Woodrow, long before that, back in the 1960s, Simon Townsend was one of Australia's most courageous conscientious objectors to conscription and being conscripted into the army and going to Vietnam. And the army actually forcibly dragged him out of his home, forcibly inducted him into the army, and when he refused to take orders, they brutalized him in an army stockade for some considerable time before they finally realized he was a genuine conscientious objector and the army spat him out. When the army spat him out, Simon foolishly decided He wanted to be a journalist. And so he went and got a job with Rupert Murdoch. And that's how it come he turned up. Well, I was sitting in our Black Power commune one day. We'd moved our headquarters from Redfern to Bondi Junction to get away from the heat of the coppers. And so one day the phone rings and I pick it up and this bloke on the other end says, "My name's Simon Townsend." And he proceeded to tell me who he was. And I said, "Mate, I know who you are. What do you want?" He said, "Well, I'm a journalist now and I'm interested in doing a story on Black Power." I said, "Yeah, mate, no worries. Come over to Bondi, take us down to the pub, shout us a few beers, we'll tell you all about it." So he comes over. Me and Billy Craigie and Dennis was in town on the day. Gary Williams, my cousin there, the anonymous field marshal. We go down the pub. Simon starts shouting us jugs of beer on Rupert Murdoch's expense account. And we're having a grand old time. We're having a great old time. We told him all about the legal service we set up, the children's services, the health clinics, all the stuff we'd been doing in Redfern. And then at some point, Simon gets up and goes to go. And Billy Craigie, with the fist on his T-shirt, says, "Where are you going, Simon? Don't shout another round." And Simon said, no, I've got to get back to the office and write up this story. And Billy said, "No, shout another round." Simon, "No, I've got to go." So Billy winked at me and he said, "Don't go yet, Simon. We haven't told you about the explosive." And so Simon says, "Explosives?" I said, "Yeah, shout us another round. We'll tell you all about it." So for the sake of another two jugs of beer, we spin him this bullshit yarn. Oh, we only got a few small amount of explosives. And so we, after that, we went home, slept off our hangovers, forgot all about it. A couple of days later, somebody rings us up and says, "Hey, you blokes seen the papers?" We said, "No, why? What's in it?" They said, "You're in it." I said, "Oh, right." So we had a look and I said, "Oh, no." But the real effect of this article, this is the article that really got ASIO interested in it. Now, for those of you, well, you're here, so you automatically got an ASIO file now. Right? And all you got to do now that you've got an ASIO file is just wait 30 years, because after 30 years, all Australian government documents, including ASIO files, revert to the National Archive. And you, like me, can go and read your ASIO file. And here's some stuff from my ASIO file. Now, these are photographs. Well, here's a picture of me and Dennis Walker behaving suspiciously in the vicinity of the Communist Party headquarters. And I don't know what that thing in my mouth is there, but, you know, I don't remember smoking joints that big then, but anyway. And another tip for all of you who've got an ASIO file, don't be like me, because I didn't know they were doing this, and so I wasn't aware, so that's my excuse. But you know now that you've got an ASIO file, so every morning you've got to think to yourself, if you're going to a demo or something, you've got to think to yourself, you've got to think sartorially. Right? You don't want to go out and get your photo taken by ASIO if you look like a dad, like me. You've got to dress properly so that you look good when 30 years' time you're going to show people your ASIO file. You won't look like a dad like me there. So it was most entertaining reading my ASIO file. In fact, there's a movie made about it if you want to watch it sometime. I might even show it here one day. But all of this meant that this man, this was our dearly beloved, not so highly esteemed Prime Minister, Silly Billy McMahon. He used to, one of his many nicknames was the Volkswagen with ears. He was a tragic little man, vertically challenged, and with a high-pitched voice, which was an unfortunate sort of thing for a Prime Minister whose leader of the opposition was Gough Whitlam, who was 7 foot tall and had a huge booming voice. But Billy McMahon was so upset by all of this Aboriginal activity and towards the end of 71, he made a major political mistake. He decided that he needed to make a prime ministerial statement on Aboriginal land rights. Now, folks, if you're the prime minister in 1971 or 72, and you're going to make a statement on Aboriginal land rights that is going to say, I'm never going to give Aboriginal land rights, then it's not exactly a good idea to make such a statement on the most sensitive political day in the Australian Aboriginal political calendar, the 26th of January. And so Billy McMahon makes his statement on Invasion Day. It was guaranteed to get an instant reaction, which it did. That night in Redfern, a bunch of people got together in the Black Power movement. They dispatched four blokes to Canberra. The whole idea was simply to show Billy McMahon that the movement was having an instant rejection of his statement. And the idea was the boys were to go to Canberra. We'd arranged to have a photograph taken. We're hoping that the photograph would be on the front page of the paper at Canberra next day, so that Billy McMahon, when he woke up at the lodge, would choke on his cornflakes when he saw a bunch of blackfellas protesting on the lawns of Parliament House. So off they went. That's the photo they wanted. That's the boys. The idea was they'd get this photo taken. The plan was, they'd been told, the coppers will come and arrest you. Try and get the photo taken before the coppers get there. The coppers will get there, they'll arrest you, spend the night in the cells. We'll come down and bail you out the next day. That's all the plan was. That's all was supposed to happen. And so the boys get the photo taken. Now, this is the moment when the plan goes wrong. This copper, instead of sticking to the script, this copper instead informs the boys. He's saying to me, there doesn't seem to be a law preventing you from camping on the lawns of Parliament House. And the boys said, what? And the cop said, there's no law against your camping on the lawns. And the boy said, yay. And the copper said, but. And I said, but what? But you can only put 11 structures here. You put 12 tents or structures here, we can deem you a camping area and we'll come and move you. He said, but you keep 11 tents here, nothing we can do. Copper got in his car and drove away. The boys had accidentally discovered a loophole in Canberra law. There was no law for you, as long as you only had 11 tents. So the next day they get a better tent in for the office. Tony Curry, one of the blokes who went down the first time, he was the poet of the Black Power movement. He was the one who came up with the bright idea, we'll call us the Aboriginal Embassy. He said, the Prime Minister's statement has deemed us aliens in our own land. If we're aliens in our own land, we ought to have an embassy like all the other aliens. Only our embassy will be a bunch of tents on the lawns of Parliament House to reflect the reality of living conditions for Aboriginal people in New South Wales in 1972. It was a stroke of genius for an Aboriginal embassy. And so for the next 6 months, only 11 tents.
Good evening. For the first time in history, there's an Aboriginal embassy in Canberra. It's been on the lawns in front of Parliament House for some weeks. The fact that it's there at all has surprised many white Australians, and the fact that it's been there for so long has surprised even more. But for Australia's Aborigines, it's not just a matter of surprise. It's made 1972 different from any other year. It's one symbol of their growing determination to be noticed. The embassy is just one aspect of a new phase in the relationship between white and black Australians. The other is an issue, land rights. The setting up of an embassy and the intensive pressure for land rights comes from a new generation of Aboriginal spokesmen and leaders. On the whole, they're younger, more impatient and more militant than their predecessors. They're not the only Aboriginal spokesmen, of course, and they're not the only ones arguing for land rights, but they're the ones who are giving the movement its biggest push yet. And in one way or another, what they're about is black power.
we put a hole in the ground, stuck a letterbox on it, and the mail started being delivered 3 days later.
We gave ourselves portfolios. I became the Minister for Defence. I painted the curb. Every time was 6 hours only, no parking. We set them up. We were known worldwide because we used to get letters from overseas. Aboriginal tent embassy somewhere in Australia.
The tourist bus operators at Canberra realised there was a new tourist attraction in town, so they started bringing their tourists to us before they took them to Parliament House across the road. And in doing so, we were able to mount these big forums about the issues. This is only 5 years after 90% of the Australian people voted in support of Aboriginal rights, and so there was still a huge reservoir of genuine interest on the part of Australians as to what the issues were all about. And so people would turn up in droves and come to these, and there's my cousin Gary Williams educating the masses, and people from all walks of life would turn up and have these meaningful dialogues with us. But they weren't always friendly. There's big bad Solly Blair picking on a poor little old lady, and here's a poor little old lady picking on me.
We've got legal services, medical services, we've got survival programs, we're providing services for the community, we're making that community go ahead as one, which is what the community wants to do, which is what the government can't see. That should be done. They're singling out the little. If you don't want to listen to me, go away.
Hey!
We don't listen to your way.
It's listening.
We want to do our thing our way.
All I'm trying to basically say is that the time of white domination of the black movement is over. It's time for black people to do things for themselves and get things for themselves, because the only way they'll ever get anything, and we're getting it.
Nasty communists. Nasty people. Look out, there's a communist under the right.
That little old lady got off a tourist bus, interrupted a segment we were filming, picked an argument with us, then got back on the bus, and nobody ever knew who she was. And she's the star of Ningla Na, the film, you know, having a go at us, accusing us of being manipulated by communists. But this is the very moment when the Aboriginal Embassy changed the course of Australian history. We had a rally out the front one day, and all these politicians come across the road, the big note himself, and the biggest big noter of all was Big Gough. As you can see, he's about 7 foot tall, and he's standing up there, Gough Whitlam, and what he's saying is, okay, all you Aboriginal people, all you gotta do at the end of this year, December 72, there's a federal election, just vote Labor and everything will be sweet. Well, in the middle of saying that, he gets interrupted by Paul Coe. And this is the moment that Paul Coe interrupted him. And Paul Coe is saying here, he said, Mr. Whitlam, the government across the road, their policy on Aborigines is assimilation. He said, your party, the Labor Party, your policy on Aborigines is assimilation. It's been a bipartisan policy for the last 70 years or so. And Mr. Whitlam, you know as well as I do that assimilation equals genocide. A policy of assimilation equals genocide because the desired end result of a policy of assimilation is that there be no Aborigines. Now, Gough Whitlam could have easily told Coe to take a run and jump, but he didn't. Whitlam instead took to heart what Coe had said. And overnight, Gough Whitlam changed the policy of the ALP, and in doing so, ended the bipartisan approach that had been in existence for at least 70 years and made this promise.
We will legislate to give Aborigines land rights. Not just because their case is beyond argument, but because
as Australians are diminished, while the Aborigines are denied their rightful place in this nation.
Admirable words. Unfortunately, yet another broken promise, which we'll get to. Meanwhile, across the road, peeking from the curtains of Parliament House, the Prime Minister, Billy McMahon, muttering to his Attorney General, Ivor Greenwood, he said, Ivor, these black bastards across the road, they're getting too effective. We've got to do something about the bastards. What can we do? Ivor Greenwood says, well, Prime Minister, the only thing you can do is pass a new law making it illegal to camp on the lawns of Parliament House, which is exactly what they did. And within minutes of that law being gazetted, the police moved in on the Aboriginal embassy. And this clip's got no sound, but they caught us a bit by surprise because we didn't have enough people there to protect. We didn't have enough people there to protect the thing. And so we decided to let them take 10 of the tents away. And we said, if you touch the last tent, the office tent, then it'll be on. And you'll see me get knocked out of here in a minute. I want you to also notice when they're about to move in on the last tent, the person who stood there with us, there she is in the checkered thing, that's Faith Bandler. She was not young and she was very conservative, but she stood there with us and she linked arms with us that day, and I've never forgotten that, because it took a lot of guts this day, because this footage of these events went round the world. I was a cheeky black bastard in there, mate. And so then it was on. And this was only the first. That's Bobby McLeod, great singer-songwriter, even better cop fighter. You see me get knocked out here any second? Here we go. Oh. That's me. They not only knocked me out, they dragged someone over and dumped him on me, then woke me up and arrested me. Oh. That was quite a fight, and that night, those images went around Australia, and everywhere around Australia, even in Western Australia, blackfellas jumped in their cars and headed to Canberra. So that 3 days later, a couple of thousand of us turn up, re-erect the tent, and defy the police to take it down. Another word of advice. Another word of advice to young activists. It's not always a good idea to defy the police to do something, because invariably they will. And another thing I want you to watch with these coppers when they move in on us, look at them. They're not armed, they haven't got guns, they haven't got tasers, they haven't got batons, they haven't got shields, they haven't got pepper spray. And just think about what the coppers look like at your demos nowadays. Yeah. You know, that's the extent to which Australian police have been militarised in just 50 years.
Yeah. away from the
tent.
And also
expecting
that you remove the
tent as well. It's
Mitch Thompson,
isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm making your point. I'm asking you now to turn away and take the tent with you.
Yeah, there was lots of them. They managed to beat us again. But 1 week later, 3,000 of us turn up, re-erect the tent, but this time we were aware of what we were up against. This time, every member of what was then the ACT police, these days they call them the federal police, but in those days they were the ACT police, every member of the ACT police was on duty that day in front of Parliament House. I've always said it was would have been a good day to rob a bank somewhere else in Canberra. Not only was every member of the ACT police force there, there was also two squads from the New South Wales Police Riot Squad that had been shipped over the border overnight and were hidden behind Parliament House. And not only that, the army, the Royal Military College at Duntroon in Canberra, was on special alert with troops and a helicopter if needed. Now folks, we might be a bunch of blackfellas, but we're not stupid. So we had a meeting amongst ourselves and we said, we came here 6 months ago simply to get a photo taken. We've achieved miles more than we could have ever imagined. So do we really want to have one more brawl with the coppers, or will we call it a day? So we negotiated with the coppers. We said, listen, we will allow you to take symbolically a bit of canvas from above the head of a group of people who sit there and won't resist, and we'll form an alley that you can walk down, and we're going to orchestrate this, and we're going to claim the moral victory on the day. The police said, fine. As you'll see in this next clip, the police played their part in our little drama perfectly. I put it to a bit of Jimmy Cliff music. Now look at this, marvellous acting by the cop. The historical significance of the embassy is that it brought an end to the era of assimilation, which was a significant thing on anyone's terms. It put Aboriginal affairs onto the national political agenda, where it stays to this day, and all the other things there that I can't see and I can't read. But the most important, well, one of the most important, is the last one. Gough Whitlam always said, that the Aboriginal Embassy played a key role in the final destabilisation of the McMahon government and bringing to an end 23 consecutive years of Conservative government in Canberra. When I was at the embassy, I was 22 years old, and never in my lifetime had there been anything but a Conservative government in Canberra. Most of those years was Menzies, but there was a collection of miserable mongrels after him. So we helped to bring an end to that 23 years of Conservative government, and that's why so many people in Australia, including us, were so pleased when Gough Whitlam got in, even though Gough Whitlam sold us out in the end. He was elected. A reminder of what he said.
We will legislate to give Aborigines land rights.
I forgive Whitlam a little bit because he got knocked off before he had a chance to do what he could have done, and it was the CIA that knocked him off. If you don't believe me, come and sign up for one of my courses and I'll show you exactly how the CIA played a key role in fucking over Whitlam. But that's another story. And that, folks, is the end. Thank you. You're happy, folks. Thank you for coming. Your attendance has exceeded my expectations. I'm really pleased to see you all here, and you're welcome to any other events that we ever hold here at any time. This is an important community space that Ngāti Mun Waro is developing here, that we're going to help them build, and we're going to hold a lot of political talks and film nights and things for the broader Aboriginal community to bring back the spirit that was here in this community 50 years ago. So thanks for your attendance and thank you.
Hell yeah, what a fantastic talk. All right, guys, thank you so much for coming today. Now, I'd like to do a few thank yous while we're here for everyone who contributed, of course, yourselves. But I want to thank Ngāti Mun Waro again for giving this beautiful place. Again, come to the smoking ceremonies at 9:30 a.m. Mondays and Fridays. Second, I want to thank 3CR who has recorded this. If you want to hear the talk again, it'll be on the show, breakfast show, 9:30 tomorrow morning. Thanks, 3CR. All right, beautiful. Now, we've been CDMS. We're your lovely Sunday and other times marshals. If I'm going to be punching a dart out the front, please come by, say hi to me or another CDMS member. Get on the chat. We're going to be doing a lot more of these political workshops. We've got advanced training. If you want to walk down the street wearing an armband and maybe get punched by a cop, we can help you with that as well. Thank you very much, and give it up again for Professor Gary Foley.